Welcome back to Behind the Play. My name is Alex Adams, and today I'm joined by one of my favorite writers out there in the basketball ecosystem, the one and only Eric Korine, who covers the Toronto Raptors. Thanks so much for taking the time and doing this, Eric. What's it like to cover a team that's on a 14 game losing streak, and it feels as though it makes sense. It's not like the team's in a sense even disappointing anyone.
Yeah, it's tough. As I was telling you beforehand, after last season, I was sort of anxious for them to, as the phrase goes, pick a lane, because I wasn't sure if I could do another year of, well, they're not really going all in this way, or they're not really going all in that way, and there are only so many columns you can write about that. There are only so many analysis pieces where like you're describing why they're doing what they're doing, even if like people might not agree with it. And so I got my wish. They picked a lane, and the four best players on the team, not promptly, but like got either injured or, in the cases of RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickley, like obviously suffered personal losses that nobody wants to see. But if, as I've said many times, if you take the four best players away from what was trending to be like a 32 win team, you're going to get the equivalent of an 8 or 9 win team. Like it's not terribly surprising again. And the head coach Darko Rajakovic talks about wanting to see better focus and better energy, but I don't know. You watch the first quarter of that game against the Lakers on Tuesday night, and Barrett and Quickley are both back, and you see how much, even if it couldn't be sustained, how much a little, starter caliber talent makes a difference. So it's weird because like they're not happy they're losing, but everybody sort of understands what the deal is. And I think the As like I haven't even felt more mo a lot of outrage from the fans. It's mostly just, they're punting on the rest of the season and wake them up when the draft comes or when the season comes next year. So, and I get it, but it's hard to find what matters within that context.
And with that, I feel like for fans, you alluded to it right now, the big thing for fans is looking at the draft lottery and the odds. And the Raptors are right now sixth. They have a top six protected pick, as you know. Where do you fall in the line just in terms of team tank to get the pick this year, but then you have to convey it next year in an arguably better draft? Where do you see that as the maybe the best outcome for the Raptors?
I don't know is the answer. Like I've asked people, and the main reason I don't know is because I don't study drafts. Like I the my draft studying will happen closer to the events. Like I just, as an MBA writer, if you're doing it right, there's not enough time to watch enough college basketball, let alone international basketball, where many of the top prospects are from this year. The people I trust, and basically everybody says this year is a relatively weak draft, especially at the top. That doesn't mean there aren't won't be finds. Like a lot of people have compared it to the 2013 draft, which indeed, if you look at the first 10 picks, you're not going to find that much, but you'll find Giannis Antetokounmpo 15th or Rudy Gobert 27th. So it's not like you can't find, even if there isn't a Giannis type, a multiple MVP winner, like there will probably be an all-star, and there will probably be a bunch of guys who have 500 game careers. So it's hard to answer because, as you said, they owe the pick. It continues to be top six protected, but if their pick falls outside of that next year or in 2026, they would then give it to the Spurs, and those classes will probably be deeper than this, than deeper and more, talent heavy at the top. I've sort of been of the mind that from a team building standpoint, they would be better off giving up the pick this year, like even if it ends up being the seventh overall pick, just because it gives you clarity. You don't have to worry about that hanging over your head anymore. And if the right opportunity comes along to trade for a player that helps you win, you don't have to say, well, we still owe this pick. And not that I think that, direction is particularly likely. They're building around a younger player in Scotty Barnes and a younger core, but the clarity is helpful. But my colleague who covers the draft, Sam Vecenie at The Athletic, said because looking at the trades they made, how they got, instead of going all in on draft picks, they got, two young players who, one who's already on his second contract in RJ Barrett, one who's about to be on his second contract in Emmanuel Quickley, plus Barnes, who the Raptors will likely extend this summer. Like, they don't, it might be helpful to get that talent in the door now and figure it out later. So reasonable minds can disagree. I still sort of think that you need top high-end talent to win in this league, and you're more likely to get it next year in 2026. Chances are you're not going to finish bottom six in all 3 years. If you do, you might have problems with Scotty Barnes at that point. So I'd probably rather convey the pick this year, but I don't feel as strongly about it as I did maybe a month or two ago.
And how important is that with which, if the picks this year or next year, that they find that player to be around Scotty Barnes? And is this really their one chance at it? Or do you think like how good do you think Scotty Barnes can be, I guess, ultimately?
Another great question, another divisive topic. Less so this year, obviously, than less than if we were doing this a year ago. It's interesting when your best player is not a scorer at heart, and even though he's made strides there, his 3-point shooting fell off as the year went on. Before he broke a bone in his hand, probably ending his season. He doesn't have that soft touch inside the rim, which isn't, he's almost averaging 20 points a game, and even in today's NBA, you can't do that by, being bad at scoring, but it's not what he loves to do. It's not how he's driven. He's good enough, I think, to be an all NBA level player. I watched Pascal Siakam make all NBA twice. I don't, I think Scotty Barnes, just from a pure talent standpoint, is more talented than Pascal Siakam. Now, there's a bunch of other things. There are a bunch of other things that go into becoming a great NBA player. And, Barnes' work ethic and how he works, more than how much work he puts in, have been, topics of discussion. And I don't want to speculate on that, but there, let's just say there were never any questions about Pascal Siakam because he had to scrape his way into his position. And same for Fred VanVleet, and we could go on. So we'll see what becomes of it. I think, the best version of Scotty Barnes is probably a first team NBA, all NBAer. I don't think that's the likely outcome. But we've seen players have great third and fourth years and then sort of plateau there. So it's going to be up to Barnes. I think he can be a really good piece. And if I were to guess, like, and that we're so early, it's ridiculous to say that. But I think, like, the average outcome is he develops into, like, the second best player. He could be the second best player on a championship team, which, by the way, is a really, really good player. That's like a top, 15, top 10, maybe even player. Like, if you say, like, you need one of the top six or seven guys in the league at any point to really win, like, if you end up with the 13th best guy, that's pretty special. And I think, Barnes should just be shooting to maximize his own ability and not really think of it in these terms. But from the route from like an average outcome, I could see Barnes being, a multi-time all-star, makes a few all NBA teams. That's sort of where I would put his average outcome.
And the Raptors have really tried to surround him. Obviously, we've alluded to the trades and stuff, but with RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickley, and RJ's probably surpassed most people's expectations. Emmanuel Quickley probably lukewarm at best. But just what do you have you made of their start so far to the Raptors, to the Raptors tenures, and Are they the right pieces to surround around Scotty Barnes?
Well, with Quickly, you get the fit immediately. He's coming from New York where he wasn't the lead point guard, which means he's used to, like, even though he was the point guard in many lineups, in a lot of those lineups, he was either playing with Jalen Brunson or he was playing with Julius Randle and RJ Barrett, who had the ball in their hands a lot. So this is like an excellent shooter who spaces the floor, who has some ball handling and playmaking ability, but doesn't need to monopolize the ball. And that's kind of the player type you would draw up to play with a multi-dimensional, power forward, let's call him, for the lack of a better word, who can work as the handler, who can work as a playmaking roller. So that makes sense. There's not much to it. Not much to it. How good Quickly can be is still yet to be determined. Again, the second half of this season, it's been hard to judge much of anything. As you said, RJ Barrett's been awesome, offensively. Like, he's at a level of efficiency that he just hasn't been at before as a scorer. He had this bounce pass in transition last night, to Grady Dick, which was like just an awesome pass, and in general, his playmaking has gone up. They need him, and if not him, they'll need someone else to be able to take a bigger defensive load on. This team has two plus defenders right now, Barnes and Jakob Poeltl. My guess is when this team gets really good, Poeltl is either not on the team or playing a lesser role. It just, from an age, again, from an age standpoint, it makes sense to try and get that pick back. You traded for him at some point. But, which is all to say, when you trade Pascal Siakam and OG Anunoby, like, a lot of defensive just ball stopping is goes out the door. And Barnes' best role defensively is as sort of an off-ball helper, a chaos agent. He's a playmaker. He's not necessarily a get down in your stance and guard guys player. And you and if he's your top option, I'm not sure how practical it is to have him be that. So if RJ Barrett can grow in that area, not even becoming a stopper, but just becoming league average or a little better there, that'd be great. He hasn't shown he can do that yet, but again, the circumstances are less than ideal for, a defensive to make a defensive leap right now. They're sort of lost without Jakob Poeltl. As my colleague pointed out, Michael Grange of Sportsnet, I think they're now 2-23 without Poeltl on the year, which is he was worth that first round pick. So that'd be a great next step for him, but overall you can't complain with what he's done. And his and Barnes' fit was the questionable one, and there was a lot of debate at the time of acquiring Barrett whether like he was a throw-in or like something that was the Raptors had to take, and obviously they had to take it for money matching purposes. But it seems like he can fit in better, and the things that it will come down to, like it does for a lot of players who aren't at the absolute center, is can he take a bit of a leap offensively, or sorry, defensively, and can he take a bit of a leap as a three-point shooter? We've seen the latter, although on not a huge volume, which is fine. But the defense probably remains the biggest question with him.
I feel like throughout this 14 game losing streak, I just check through like the score, like NBA.com, and look for Grady Dick's stat line from each night. What have you liked from his game so far? And obviously he had a tough start to the season. Is it as simple as he's finding a shot, or what else is there that you've seen in his game?
Well, it's funny, like his very start to the season, like I like maybe the preseason and the first three or four games, like he wasn't making his shots, but you could see the player there. You can see like, oh, he's like pump faking, and because guys are closing out so hard to him, and he's getting into the paint and making the next play, or He's getting a hand on a loose ball on either the offensive or defensive glass. Like, he mixes it up, and considering he's not near filled out as he presumably will be in the future, that's a great sign. And then, I can't say what causation is, but the shots continued to not fall, and you saw less of those things. And like, even though this is a was a development-minded organization, even, to an extent before the Siakam and Anunoby trades, he was hurting them so much just from a defensive standpoint that they couldn't keep him on the floor. And it didn't make sense to keep him here and give him 4 minutes, 5 minutes every quarter. That's just not a great way to develop somebody. And they sent him down to the G League, where he was frankly not very good in a bigger role. So the way he has improved has been surprising given that performance. My colleague Blake Murphy, who watches the 905 a lot closer than I did, said like he sort of didn't deserve to be called back up and thrown into the rotation after those trades based on what he did with the G League in with the 905. Not to say like we understand why he was in it, but like strictly on merit, he didn't necessarily deserve to get in there. And the biggest thing is he got a bit stronger, which means he can hold his own a bit better on defense. But another thing strength does is it allows, like, it makes shooting easier. It just does. If you have, sturdier legs and a stronger foundation, the NBA three doesn't seem quite so long. And so, like, he obviously started drilling from the corners. He's one of the best corner three shooters for the season. That's even including his start to the year. And now you see him working to get above the break, which are harder and further shots, but he's starting, that's coming around. And you can see where his instincts are as a playmaker and sort of as a guy who attacks closeout. So, with that shooting pedigree, it was hard to believe that wasn't going to come around. And I would project that it will continue to come around, and he'll be one of the, a very good 3-point shooter from all areas on the floor. Again, it's going to be his defense to an extent that determines his floor, because if he can't guard anybody, I mean, he can already guard some guys, but if he is an above or below average option for his entire career, then that's going to put a cap on him as, a fifth starter or probably a bench guy. So that's where his floor comes. His ceiling comes as a playmaker. His ceiling comes as a guy who can run a little pick and roll, who can run weak side actions. Sorry for all the jargon.
No, I love.
And I think we're, and what I'm most encouraged about is like, yeah, he makes mistakes, but you see him making plays in those scenarios. I think the decision making at the rim is probably the most glaring thing for him right now. Like, he doesn't, first of all, he's just not strong enough. So when there's legal contact in the air, he sort of does the Chris Boucher thing where he's all of a sudden sort of horizontal as opposed to vertical. And that should change over time. And he just doesn't quite know always when to challenge a rim protector and when to pull up or when to make the next pass. But you see all of that in flashes, and that leads me to believe, okay, you pump him up with some more reps in the context that he should be in, as opposed to the most tenured guy on the Raptors, as he's been in some of these games, by strictly by Raptors tenure, not by NBA tenure. And he should figure it out. So it's been a really, it's not like he's lit the world on fire, but it's been a strong second half to the season. And I think the Raptors can feel relatively good about, certainly about the trajectory of his rookie season, but about the momentum he should have. Not that that's a concept I really believe in a ton, but like, there are clear things to work on, and there are clear strengths that are already there, which gives you a clear plan to put into place for the summer.
From one rookie to the other, we obviously have Darko Rajakovic as a rookie head coach. Just how would you assess his first season as Raptors head coach? And it's hard to glean a lot too, because it's been basically three or four teams throughout the season.
Yeah, I more or less wouldn't assess it. And I know that's, people who are critical, and criticizing coaches is easy, and I think the media tends to, despite what coaches think, not be as critical of coaches as many fans, especially many fans online, are. Just because, we see the limitations that they're working with. We know this is a league based on talent. And like, would I have liked to see, fewer 30, 40 point losses in this 14 game losing streak? Sure, but like, I can't really fault him for, the Raptors sort of knowing when they're cooked and not giving it. That's even strong to say they're not trying, just being like totally and completely overmatched at times. I think there are legitimate questions about, in-game decisions, about rotations, especially from the beginning of the year when he sort of stuck with, some Scottie plus bench lineups for too long. But those aren't the reasons why he was brought to Toronto. Like that's what I keep coming back to. Like he was brought likely, like the Raptors didn't know it at the time, but they had a good feeling what direction they were probably going on. And he's such a positive but sort of firm leader, and he's somebody who's really focused on the development area. And my read is there's time. This is a guy, by the way, who hasn't been a head coach at any level for 9 years, and there's got to be some rust associated with that, just in terms of in-game decision making. So their bet is there's time for that to come back to him and for him to get better at it, period, as the Raptors retool their roster and get to the next stage. I like where he's been in terms of his sort of his attitude. I think, just the style of play offensively, agree with it, disagree with it, the team is doing it. So that's, and especially in the wake of how successful they have been from a wins loss perspective, that they have continued to pass the ball and move the ball and tried to play that way throughout, more or less, says a lot about the respect and buy-in he gets. So it's a muddled answer. I don't think you can say he's going to be the next great Raptors coach. I don't think you can say he's a bust. I think there are probably more positive signs than negatives, but there's, it's sort of a big TBD.
I feel like with the Raptors, since the championship, there was a lot of a bit of a cloud nine for management with Bobby and Masai. And it feels as though the last maybe year or two, especially maybe since that Jakob Poeltl trade, their level of confidence with their fans is diminished quite some. For you, as someone around the team, watching them every day, how much trust do you have in Masai and Bobby in terms of turning the ship around and becoming maybe not a championship contender in the near term, but a good team and the right people to steady the ship?
I sort of think two things can be true at once. Like, you look at their last, let's call it 3 years, because before that they were really doing a lot in service of, not that they said it, but maybe we could get Giannis Antetokounmpo. They couldn't. So let's go to 2021. I don't think their track record's very good in those 3 years. I think, specifically at last year's trade deadline, not only in the Poeltl trade, but by not trading OG Anunoby and not trading Pascal Siakam, they missed a key leverage point that could have I don't know if sped up is the right term, but could have sort of consolidated and set them up maybe a bit more strongly to build around Scotty Barnes. And I get, and again, like this is, I get why they did it. I get, you see how Pascal Siakam's impacted the Pacers. You see how OG Anunoby has impacted the Knicks when he's been healthy. You see what Fred VanVleet's done in Houston. Like those are really good players, and I get not wanting to give up on that idea. And still, I think, at the time I wrote, I thought it was the wrong decision, and I think it was. How much they lost because of that, they lost some sort of return, although I don't think a notable return on Van Vliet. Anunoby, and especially Siakam, I would say they probably lost out on something, like it might just be a pick or two here or there, but like those things matter. And then you're also not down a pick if you don't trade for Poeltl. And now you're probably worse this year too, which means you have a shot at an even better prospect than they might have. Not that I mean, they could win the lottery, so who knows? But so I think that can be true. And you can also realize that they were very, they were exceptionally good for a long time, in the margins. And with both the extremely good and the not very good portions, some bit of luck is involved. I think people would say I over attribute things to luck. I don't think we really acknowledge it enough as being a thing. So I think they have proven over time that they can be a very good front office, and they've missed. Maybe they got a little bit into the Raptors' way, but it would, like, even if I were to say the phrase Raptors exceptionalism and they believed in it, like, I don't really have a ton of proof that this was the case, but they obviously, the development system that they were so known for stopped churning out contributors. And at some point, you have to wonder, was it specifically what we were doing before that allowed us to find those guys? Or did we happen to find some special guys and maybe it was a bit lucky? And I think the answer is probably a bit of both, right? But like, you can't get over reliant on thinking that you have the secret sauce, if you will. So I think that will be the biggest thing to watch, is what they do, let's say with the Pacers pick they have this year, how they start to or continue to use their two ways and their second round picks when they have them. And so it's like a front office I have a reasonable degree of trust in. I certainly don't think a championship front office 5 years later should be, fired, like, unless there's something beyond the on-court product going on, or if, like, the Raptors had somehow, it's funny, like, if they had gone all in for Damian Lillard, I sort of would have thought that would be more egregious than what they ultimately did. But like, look, they've got to prove it. And, the ownership group is changing. That will maybe change things for Masai Ujiri at the top and Bobby Webster and those below him working in the front office. That probably, to be honest, one of the most fascinating stories
Yeah,
in
it is.
Toronto sports is how Larry Tanenbaum is, slowly stepping away, not stepping away, but taking a bit of a step back from MLSE, and that means Rogers and Bell gain a bigger control of them, or it often means, I think, in sort of the power brokering way, it will mean they have a bigger say in what goes on with MLSE. And both of those companies are, accountable to shareholders. So that will be interesting to monitor. But back to your question, I think, it's prove it time, but it's not like or else
Yeah,
time
yeah.
either. That's where I sort of sit.
What do you think, like heading into the off season, what do you think this team does with regards to Bruce Brown, Gary Trent? Like obviously the pick makes it changes a lot of things as well, if it's conveyed or not, but what are do you think some of the goals for this team in the off season? Emmanuel Quickley as well. Just maybe your general thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, we can take it one step at a time. Trent, I've sort of gone back and forth on. I'm back to like I would be surprised if he's back. Masai Ujiri has a history of wanting to retain the asset, but I just don't think Trent is the type of player that you can afford to overpay in this scenario. And like he's still young enough to contribute. He's a good NBA player. And if you can keep him at like just over the mid-level, like $14 or $15 million a year, like that's fine. But that would also be a pay cut for him in a league where the salary cap is going up. So, and there's also a bunch of young teams that really need shooters, and Trent sort of fits. So I think you can sort of replace what he does a bit, most of what he does at a much cheaper cost. Bruce Brown, it will depend on what's out there in the trade market. Best case scenario, you can get a some sort of pick equity for him before the year, I think, before the draft. I don't think that's likely. I think he'll probably be back and they'll kick the can down the road and see if they can do this again next, some point next year. And quickly he's going to get paid. He's going to get paid like a starting point guard who hasn't, reached an all-star NBA, all-NBA status. And I don't think people, maybe fans aren't familiar with that being like a 4-year, $120 million contract or something, but that like, and those are just numbers I'm pulling out, out of my you know where, but like, that's what starter money is now. Like if you're an NBA starter, and we can have question a longer conversation about Emmanuel Quickley about whether he's that, and I don't think he's proven it, but there's, reason to believe he can be that. That you're going to get paid about 25, 30, $33 million a year. So that's what's going to happen, and it's just a matter of, not to get too far into minutia, if like they could clear a bunch of cap space by letting Trent and go, and by declining the team option on Brown. But I don't really think that's makes much sense given the options of who they could sign out there. I think they're just gonna continue to try and build, continue to try and get young talent in the door with whatever way they can, with whatever methods they have at their disposal, and go from there. And it might not be a very sexy off season, and which is maybe problematic when you're raising price tickets or ticket prices after a bad year. Masai did say after the trades that he was going to continue to be patient, and even if it took a few years, he was going to build this thing the right way. And like I said, he was probably a step or two behind in terms of doing that, but I see no reason why he would all of a sudden take some shortcuts in order to make a big off-season splash right now.
Well, I hope for my viewing experience that there's less 14 game losing streaks next year, and for your sake really, and that they're maybe a bit healthier and a bit more continuity. I think the continuity is almost a given, but you obviously today, for people that when this podcast comes out, Vince Carter was elected to the Hall of Fame, and I know you grew up with Vince. I was just a baby when Vince was dominating the NBA, and obviously was such an icon here in Toronto. Just what do you remember of the Vince Carter experience, and do you believe that he deserved to be a Hall of Famer, and how should maybe his time in Toronto be remembered?
I sort of have no opinions on who should be in the Hall of Fame and who shouldn't, just because it's an amorphous concept defined by nothing. So whatever. Like congratulations to him, congratulations to everybody else who makes it. I don't really know what it stands for, and that's fine. Look, like I was 10 when the Raptors were born, started playing, I should say. And like, they really seemed like they were going to be a laughing stock forever, like after those first 3 years. And you have so much change. You have Isaiah Thomas in and out of the franchise. You have your first star, Damon Stoudamire, in and out of the franchise. You have a 16 and 66 season where that 17 game losing streak or franchise record took place. You have Glenn Grunwald, the GM, basically apologizing to everybody at the end of that season. Vince, as a young kid, it was just so, and with certainly a bit of an inferiority complex about my own favorite team, the two joke expansion teams from Canada. It was so cool. Vince was so cool, and it was awesome that he made the Raptors cool. And like, there was nothing like seeing a Vince in-game dunk over, like, I can recall the big man, whether it was, Dikembe Mutombo or Rick Smits early on. Like, it was breathtaking. That slam dunk contest, everybody knows about it. It was awesome. And look, as a fan, I had real problems with how he handled his exit. I don't blame fans who still don't love it, even after, the organization and him see, in 2014 seemed to say enough is enough, let's be friends. But he's definitely like, my colleague Doug Smith at the Star called him, I think, I don't want to misquote him, as something like the most important figure in franchise history. I think that's right, in terms of just like helping stabilize the franchise from the lowest point to a point where, they could be with the Leafs in an ownership group, and they could really stand on their own on the power of Carter's sheer star power. So like, those are mostly my memories. And I also remember him missing that last shot. And I was at all those playoff games and the home
Were
playoff
you?
games in 2001
Wow.
as a fan. I remember that 50-point game. It was just unbelievable. I remember him missing that shot, sitting in my friend's living room against Philly. He missed that shot. I was kind of annoyed, but went home and being like, this team is set up. Like, there is going to be a long run. And, again, that's why you shouldn't take the Raptors' previous run of success for granted, because you never really know. But it was a special time, and even though better years in terms of consistent success, predictable success were to come, none of it made the Raptors, I think, quite as cool and marketable as Carter did. And like, even when they won the championship, even when the We the North stuff blew up, that was sort of something that became very big in Toronto, became very big in Canada, but it didn't transcend the league in a way that Vince Carter did. And so you can argue he made them bigger than they, in that metric alone, he made them bigger than they have ever been since. I don't believe that, like, to be true in a more, in a realer way, but just in terms of star wattage attention, I think, he brought the Raptors to something approaching their peak. And it was a special time to be a fan. And even with the agony of the protracted exit, it was really cool looking back on it.
For sure, but I would say I think Drake might have some qualms about the stardom and the Raptors logo and name, but
We were talking cool, right? I'm joking. I love you, Drake.
exactly. With Vince Carter, before I let you go, obviously I covered the Canadian men's national team. Vince Carter, in a lot of ways, is a big reason for why Canada, there's so many Canadian basketball players in the NBA. So I have a couple, really two questions for you. And the first one is just they're going into Paris. They know their group, but they also don't really know their group because of some Olympic qualifying shenanigans. So, but just for the roster that they take to Paris, who would be the 12 guys you send to Paris?
I think there are some non-negotiables who have played parts throughout. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Lu Dort, Dylan Brooks, RJ Barrett, Kelly Olynyk, Melvin Ejim, Dwight Powell's probably there. Nickeil Alexander-Walker's probably there. Am I missing an obvious guy who has been playing?
No, those
I
all those
don't
guys were
think
there
so.
this summer.
If Jamal Murray's healthy and available, he plays, so that's nine. Then it gets complicated. The thing they could really use, I think there are probably two things. One is like a really steady guard, and I think that's where somebody like Andrew Nembhard could really help them. He's a guy who's participated for Canada before, and him not participating in the last few years has everything to do with where he was in his NBA career, and less to do with, they're asking for 3-year commitments, and it's just, you can't really do that if you're on a rookie scale contract in the NBA. It's a hard thing to get your team to agree with as you're coming into the league. But he'd be somebody I look at carefully. For that reason, I sort of think Zach Edey would be unlikely this year. That's not based on any reporting. That's based on like just how teams tend to handle these situations. And it's not like Zach Edey is a no doubt can't miss prospect, as awesome as he's been in the NCAA tournament. So I would imagine the team will, whoever drafts him, will want to get a closer look at him. And I'm not sure how that flies with, being a part of Raptors, of Team Canada training camp, then maybe going to Summer League with that team, and then going back with Canada. Like it seems like an unlikely path, especially for a guy who will have some, work to do on his body and with how his team and his support system thinks he should sort of be and look in the NBA. So I think that's unlikely. And they could really use size because, like, France is going to be pretty huge, and the US, even if they don't get Joel Embiid because of his injury situations, I know he's back, but being back and then participating internationally in the summer are two different things, but they'll be a big team. There are lots of other skilled big men out there. I think people can remember the game against the Czech Republic in Victoria in 2021. I don't even remember the guy's name, but he destroyed the Raptor or Team Canada. So it helps to have size there, and I just don't really think there's a 7-footer out there who's going to be a huge difference maker. So then you want as much useful size and shooting as you can get. I'm not going to like pick the last two spots or anything like that. And I do think the guys who made the commitments and have kept those commitments up really, you can't say it. I mean, you can do whatever you want, but I would have a tough time having known that they made those commitments and then backing out to take quote unquote better players. So I don't think it will come to that. But that's sort of where I stand on the team.
What do you make of maybe, the Andrew Wiggins dilemma a little bit, just because he has played for Canada before, has had a really rocky season, but seems to be playing better. He was the face of Canada basketball until Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Where do you stand on him maybe playing for Canada this summer?
I'm not against it. I think he could obviously help the team, especially in that way I spoke about in terms of defensive size. If that's a position of need and you can't fill it with the guys who have made a commitment, and I understand why he didn't make a commitment at the time. He was, had to sort of resurrect his career, and obviously had that paid off in a big way, both in terms of a championship and another contract. So this isn't to criticize him for not making a 3-year commitment when he didn't make that, but some other guys did, and they're sort of a owed right of first refusal. But I'm not against him playing, and I think he'd be a really good option if that's the position they get to.
What maybe lastly, what would be a good Olympics for this group? Is it getting a medal? Is it getting out of the group stage? It is such a tough tournament, and they'll be in a
These teams
really.
are awesome. These teams are awesome. Like, there will be one or two teams who like don't belong there in terms of just in terms of keeping up. And then like the 10 other teams, like it's probably the US, assuming they super team it up. And then it's nine other teams that are separated by, gradations. They're capable of meddling. That should be the goal. But I don't think it's a failure if they lose to some very good teams along the way. The expectation is that they're right in it against teams as good as Australia, what we think France will look like, what we think Spain will look like if they make the tournament, Serbia, Slovenia. They've beaten some of these teams already, so like it's not out of the realm that they could do it again. But if you're gonna define it by winning a 4-point game or losing a 4-point game, like I just sort of fundamentally don't think that's how things should be judged if it comes down to that. As long as they're competitive, playing together and continue to build together as a group, and put themselves in a position to, be in those games and be equals, then I think you got to be happy. And that's again, I tend not to provide a lot of easy, simple, quotable answers in all of my work, and this is another one of those. But
That's fair.
that's what I believe in.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's sort of how I see it.
No, I mean, I totally agree. Just it's so deep now compared to even 10 years ago in men's basketball internationally. But I would say the one thing I hope for is that there's a little bit of Dillon Brooks versus USA. I'd pay a lot of money to watch him go at LeBron James or whoever. So I hope that happens for the sake of my own sake, but
Yeah, Dylan the Villain is a
yeah.
great character, and it is fun to watch. Everybody ex aside from Memphis Grizzlies and Houston Rockets fans have been on the other side of that, so it's fun to get to be on his side. And like he was, everybody remembers Shai's shots in that game against Spain that got them to the tournament, like, or got clinched the spot in the Olympics. Dillon Brooks hit some huge threes in that fourth quarter comeback, and that sort of put Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in position to lock down the game when he did.
Yeah, the best 1-2 combo in the whole tournament, right? So it'll be exciting to watch. And before I let you go, Eric, thanks so much for taking the time. Is there anything at The Athletic you want to plug just in the next couple of weeks or even stories that you have had out now?
I have a big feature coming out, hopefully before the season ends. I can't really, I don't want to talk about it in case something falls apart, but it's, sort of the style of story I've written a few times before, an in-depth piece on a player and what his week looks like. Somebody who's not necessarily in the center of things. So hopefully that is smooth and can come out before the season ends. I might be doing some play-in stuff.
Cool.
I'd go into Miami for those last games, so if the Raptors, if Miami is hosting the play-in or playing in the play-in, I might be there, so that'll be fun, especially if
Awesome.
it's like a Miami, Philly,
Yeah.
Embiid, Lowry, Nick Nurse, a bunch of characters I'm familiar with, so that'd be fun. I don't really know what's coming after that. It's time for everybody in my life, and to say, so what do you do when it's not basketball season? And for me to like get mad, and my wife to remind me that people genuinely don't know and are asking. They're not asking it to drive me crazy. So yeah, we're gonna work on my patience with people too, but I don't think people should be looking out for that.
It's contemplating your life after a failed Raptor season. I think that's.
Yeah, although that is one of my expertises, so by the at this point, I'll figure it out. But yeah, I'll continue to be writing at The Athletic to some extent, and maybe they'll even have a bunch of or a lottery pick to get people excited slash angry. We'll see.
Exactly. Well, maybe a number one overall pick, and maybe turns out maybe a bit better than Andrea Bargnani. So we'll hope for that. And thanks so much for taking the time and doing this, Eric. I love your work, and I'll definitely be reading more, whatever's coming out next. And thanks again.
Thanks for having me, Alex.